As we began our overview of the church period called the Middle Ages last week, we began to see that it was a period from 590 to 517, and we saw that really you could characterize it as a period filled with chaos and confusion. It was the barbarian invasions, the fall of the Roman Empire. We're going to see where all of what the known structure was going to collapse. And I can only imagine how my heart would have been shaken by that, to see the known world and all of its structures just crumble to the ground. And yet we're going to see that God is going to use one institution, the church, as a normalcy, as a consistent line, consistent stalwart where you can turn to. And that, I think, will come out. One church historian has said that the Middle Ages was a period of slow growth. Now, that's different than what we talked about. Some would show that there was no growth, that it was a static period, or that it was even a reversal of the ancient period where all of the doctrines in the early church were coming, and all of a sudden there was this 1,000 years of darkness that are going to fall upon the church. But I don't know that that is a really fair characterization of what was going on. And this church historian would say that it was really a period of slow growth. Whether you're looking at the growth of religion or culture or education, it was growth nevertheless, in which the church is going to fulfill a useful, cultural, and religious function. And that function was to bridge the gap between the ancient city-state. You had Athens, or you would have Alexandria, or you would have Rome, and you would have cities that were the key to culture. You will have to bridge that gap in the development until you get to the nation states of where we are today, in which nations rule the world and not cities. And so you're going to have that development, and the church is going to bridge that gap. And I think that might be something to keep in mind. Steady growth, slow growth, but it was nevertheless progressing on in this great and tumultuous change in the culture of the world from a city-state to the nation-states. Well, today we want to come to the rise of the popes and the papacy. We're really going to look at three main topics. First, the rise of the popes and the papacy. And then we're going to look at the Frankish kingdom and how God is going to use this kingdom to bring stability, to allow this steady growth to go on. And then we're going to focus on one individual by the name of Gottschalk, who is going to, as we, I think, say, going to reflect the fact that Augustinianism is going to stay alive, maybe not in the mainstream, but certainly available to the church even through the Middle Ages. So let's look first of all at popes and the rise of the papacy. And we said last week that during this time period of the Middle Ages is when we're going to go from the Catholic Church to the Roman Catholic Church. And so when do we start to bring in this word Roman Catholic Church as distinguishing from the Catholic Church? Well, the first thing we're going to see that in the early church, from the time where Christ ascends back into heaven and the apostles begin the church in the book of Acts, up until 313, we're going to see that the development of the bishopric and the episcopacy, where you're going to have one individual who is going to be over multiple churches. And what we're going to find is that you'll have many bishops who are equal in rank, power, and function. They're equal. And so, and we're even going to see really that there's going to be five patriarchal churches that are going to come to the fore to control the church. Jerusalem, Alexandria, Antioch, and reading the book of Acts, that's not a surprise. We're going to see then Constantinople, and then finally Rome come to the power. And so you'll have five patriarchal churches that will be equal in rank, power, and function. They will oversee large areas in multiple churches, and these areas that they oversee, those churches are going to report to that one bishop. But something happens in 313. This is a date that I am sure is burned in your memory by now as a church historian. What happens in 313?
Constantine.
Yes, Constantine comes to the fore. I heard it whispered. Thank you, Steve. Constantine comes. God raises him up. And now Christianity is going to become the established religion of the world, at least of the Roman world, and it's going to be really what is at the center of what is going on. But from 313 to 450, we're going to see that the Roman bishop is going to come to be acknowledged as the first among equals. Notice the change. You had equals in rank and power, authority. Now Rome is going to become the first among equals. And that's a nuance, but it's nevertheless a significant change. And why do we say this? Well, first of all, the root of its authority is not going to go to the Petrine doctrine, but it's going to come, quite frankly, just naturally, out of the location, wealth, and makeup of the Roman Church. Rome was the chief city of the world. It was the Roman Empire. It had all of the trappings. It had all of the wealth. It was the richest city in the world. And so, with all the wealth that was in Rome and the people being members of the Roman Church, that wealth would be concentrated in the church, and it would give it power. It would also give it just the simple fact that it was the Roman Church gave it prestige. It spoke with authority because it was the Roman Church. And so there was this natural diminution of authority from the others as they would acquiesce to the Roman Church. And so there was a natural rise to Rome's authority. But then you're going to see later that the church is going to seek to justify its claim to the supremacy based upon it being the successor to Peter and the Petrine doctrine. And so by 450, we're going to see that Rome is now asserting its authority over all the other churches. In 450 to 590, and I think we can say in 450, we can, in my opinion, officially say the Roman Catholic Church. Now, we probably, if we were alive in that day and genuine Christians, would have been members of the Roman Catholic Church. It's different than what the Roman Catholic Church is today and our relationship to the Roman Catholic Church. But nevertheless, I think it's fair to say we would start the Roman Catholic Church at this time. And here the Roman bishops would claim supremacy over the other bishops and demand that they submit. And quite frankly, they were able to achieve that. Well, this is the rise of the papacy and an overview of it, but let's talk about individual bishops. Damasius in 366 is going to be the first one to talk about the apostolic see, meaning I have the seat that Peter was going to hold. And so he will use that word in for the first time, the apostolic. Notice the apostles. He is claiming to be in the line of the apostles and having the authority that comes with that. Next comes Leo the First, or Leo the Great. And in 440, now notice now we're talking another 60 years here between these two, so this is a slow development. But nevertheless, it's going to be Leo the Great who's actually probably going to be the first one that we would look at as a pope. And he actually uses that word for the first time, papas, father, pope, that we would use the word today. He'll be the first to use that word. He did not mean it in a demeaning or an authoritative way. His heart was probably pure in trying to say, I am the Father. I am trying to nurture and care for and oversee like a father does. But nevertheless, he's using it. You can start to see the development roll along. In 455, Emperor Valerian is going to issue a decree. Now remember, Rome is no longer the seat of the Roman Empire. That is in Constantinople in the east. And we're going to see that there will be a struggle between the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church that it will become to be. But the Emperor Valerian is going to, from Constantinople in 445, call Leo the Great the supreme head in spiritual affairs. Now, why does he do this? Why is he shifting power from the east to the west? Well, he was having a political struggle back in Constantinople, and he was struggling with the Eastern Church. And so his way of poking his finger in the Eastern Church's eye is to claim that the Roman Church is supreme and try and get an ally to his side and push down the Eastern Church. Well, it might have helped him in the short term, but in the long term, what's it doing but elevating the Roman Church even more and more and giving more precedence to the Roman Church? Then something happens in 452 and 455 that is going to help Leo consolidate his power. The barbarian invasions now are threatening the city of Rome. We're going to see that in 452, no other than Attila the Hun is coming down and to attack Rome and to pillage and do what the barbarians do. And so Leo goes out to meet him and meets with him, and he is able to make Attila the Hun leave Italy and spare Rome. Well, obviously that bolsters his standing in not only the people of Rome's eyes, but of the empire and those who had the old romantic vision of the Roman Empire, here was a leader again in the West who was able by his words and probably his prayers and his spiritual presence to turn even Attila the Hun away. In 455, the same thing happens again. This time we're going to see the Goths are going to come down and to attack Rome. This time he makes a little bit more of a compromise. He says, look, he goes to the leader and says, we'll open the gates and you can go in for 2 weeks and pillage the city and take what you want. Just don't burn it and don't kill us. And for 2 weeks, he allows them to come in. They do it. They take what they want and then they leave. But Rome survives. And again, it builds his prestige among the people. Leo insists now, also we're going to see his consolidation of power, that all the church courts, remember we said even in Augustine days, the Roman Empire gave a bishop legal authority to rule as a court, a civil court, as well as a church court. And what Leo is going to insist that is that any appeal that comes out of any church court must come to him and his court, and he becomes the final arbiter of all legal and church decisions. And they submit. He enforces that, and they do. So now you start to see the consolidation of power with Leo. And then he's going to write a book. He's called his tome, is the name of the book. And here he defines what the true positions of the church are. And he insists, for example, he'll write against the Donatists, who are still some of them running around in North Africa. Or he'll write against other false doctrines in this. And he will insist, this is the official position of the church. And you will adhere to it no matter what. And if you don't, we will bring the arm of the state to bear against you. And so again, you see his consolidation of power now even over doctrine and the enforcement of that. And so Leo the Great is probably the first pope, Roman Catholic pope. But next we come to a man by the name of Gelasius. And in 492, he's going to write a book that basically says, look, we understand that there is sacred and royal power that belongs to both popes and kings. But here's how it works, folks. Since the pope answers to God directly regarding the king, in other words, the pope is responsible for what the king does, the pope is superior and thus rulers should submit, that is, kings should submit to the pope. And so he actually writes it as an official doctrine of the church stating that the popes are over the kings. And so, again, it is starting to come into the flow of the church history. But we come to probably the greatest of the popes, Gregory the First, in 540 to 604. And I believe this was a good man. He had a great heart, and he desired good. And so when we say all of these things, I don't think we should look at these as the popes that we're going to come to know during the Babylonian captivity and the great schism up in the 1400s, and when we have competing popes and we have all of the debauchery that Rome is known for. That's not what's going on here. And any of these that we've talked about so far, we're a long ways away, 500 years, 600 years away from that kind of a pope. But nevertheless, we're seeing these popes come to power and claim it. Gregory is going to be born to a very wealthy family. He will be extremely well educated, but he will be educated to become like his father, who was the prefect of Rome. That is, he was basically the governor, not the Roman emperor, because that's over in Constantinople. But his father was basically what would be equivalent to a governor over Rome. It might be more equivalent to being like the mayor of New York. None of us live in New York City, but it is it's the largest city in the United States and has great influence. And we've seen this recently with Giuliani called America's mayor. Well, you would have that kind of prestige to be the prefect of Rome. This was his father. He's born into this wealthy family, immense amount of wealth, well-educated. He is trained as a lawyer to follow into his father's footsteps. And he is made the prefect of Rome in 570. Whether it's because of conversion or whatever reason, he gives up his power. He gives up his father's fortune. He literally gives it all away. He's going to build 7 monasteries in Italy. It's interesting to note that he was a humble man. He was a kind man. He will take the title, and what he preferred to be called is the servant of the servants of God. He really was, I think, a man who had a good heart, and he wanted to do good. In 578, he will be sent. Now remember, he's not a theologian. He's not trained in doctrine and church, but he's trained as a lawyer and a governmental official. And the Pope in Rome is going to send him to Constantinople for what, about 8 years or so, to serve as the Pope's representative to the Roman government in Constantinople. And so he does that. He's the ambassador there working in government affairs. But he will return to Rome. And when he comes back, he will become the abbot of St. Andrew's Monastery and work in that position until 590, when Pope Pelagius, no, not related to the doctrines there of Pelagianism, dies in the plague and he is made pope. Well, let's talk about some of his great achievements. First of all, he is going to expand the power of the Roman bishop. He will exercise all the powers that you and I know the popes, when we think of popes, to be. He is going to be very controlling. And this probably comes from his legal background and his governmental background, and he understands how power works, he understands how the Roman Empire works, and he's very efficient at it, and he does a good job about it. He will exercise episcopal care over the churches in Gaul, in Spain, in North Africa, in Britannia, in Italy. He will control them, and we develop what is called the pallium. Remember the scarf that you often see bishops wear? He would determine who the bishop is going to be, and to keep that power, he would send the scarf, the pallium, and he would anoint them with that scarf, giving his power to that bishop to oversee the area. And so we start to see this rise of all the, you know, the official trappings of Rome in implementing its power and prestige. John the Foster of Constantinople comes to power in the East. Remember, you have the Eastern Church, later becomes the Eastern Orthodox Church. You have the Roman Catholic Church in the West. And there's competition between these. And John the Foster is going to say, since after all they are the true Roman Empire, the capital of what's left of it is in Constantinople, he's going to say that the Eastern Church is the universal church. I am, John the Foster would say, the head of the church. Well, Gregory the Great is not going to take that very well, and he's going to oppose it and fight it, right against it, and he's able to stave off the Eastern Church's claim to supremacy. What's interesting to note, though, is he doesn't go so far as to openly state that our church is greater, that the Western Church is greater, but at least he's not going to allow an usurper to come and to take over, and he keeps that claim. The next thing he does, he has a great emphasis on mission work, particularly in Britain. He's going to send out missionaries all over the empire. He has a passion to see the barbarians and pagans come to know Orthodox Christianity. And so his greatest influence, I think, is not going to be, though it is true, the consolidation of power and what he does, but he's going to send missionaries out throughout the known world under their control. He was also an able administrator, and we see this from his training. But what's important to note is that he has so much, not of his own personal wealth, but the ability to raise enough money that he can raise an army, control an army, to fight off the Lombards who were coming to take over Rome, and it helps him keep his power. He was an able man. You can imagine all of these things he's got going on at one time, and he is able to administrate them all. Church, civil affairs, all of the courts, all of these different countries, missionary work, the things that are going on in the church, and he's able to prosper doing it. He comes up with a Gregorian chant. I know that's not on the top of our hit lists today, but the Gregorian chant, as he is developing the church in its liturgy, he is going to bring this music to bear in the church. Gregorian chant comes to the fore here. He's going to be a good preacher. He will be practical in his preaching when he preaches, and he preaches often. He is in the pulpit preaching. He'll stress humility, and he'll use allegory extensively in his preaching. He will be a prolific writer in what he does, and we have a good understanding of who he is from his own writings. He was also a theologian, maybe not one that was trained, but he would become involved in theological ideas and promotion of that. And he will do some things that we may not appreciate. He will soften, in his word, Augustinianism. Man didn't inherit Adam's guilt, but only his disease, as sin as a disease to which they were all subject, that is, all humankind. He taught free will, predestination of the saved only, and he denied irresistible grace. And so you can see what was coming about. He will teach purgatory, and for the first time we're going to have the doctrine of purgatory really coming to the fore. here in the church. He will hold the verbal inspiration of the Scriptures, but he gives tradition equality to the Scriptures. And now we start to see that Roman Catholic influence really starting to take root. The canon of the Mass is going to come, where we're going to see that when we celebrate what we call the Lord's table, they call the Mass, that Christ's body and blood will be sacrificed afresh each time, is going to come to the fore under his reign. He will use the invocation of the saints and see the development of that to start during his time. And so we can see clearly now that the Roman Catholic papacy and its popes are coming to the fore. And you can see why we would say, here is the Roman Catholic Church.
Is this the same Gregory as the Gregorian calendar? Did that happen at this point?
That's a good question, Jimmy. I don't know the answer to that, but I'll try and find that out and go back and look and see. I'm trying to think, though.
The Gregorian calendar was accepted by the British Empire back in like the 16 or so. It's quite after this.
There are a number of Gregories yet to come, and I believe those, and you'll see those like in the 13 and the 1400s. But I'm not sure that I can't say for sure. I'll have to check on that. Well, let's talk a bit. That's the rise of the papacy. We must press on. I want to come to what's going to happen when the empire breaks up in 476. You remember we say 476 is the last Roman, Western Roman emperor that is on the throne. Well, what happens? We're going to see three lines that are going to come out of the Roman Empire. The first is in Asia, or in the East. In Constantinople, we'll see the Greco-Roman Byzantine Empire exist until 1453, when it will fall in the hands of the Muslims. Now, what's important is this is the Eastern Church, and we'll see the Eastern Orthodox Church arise out of this line here. It obviously won't survive because in what is now present-day Turkey and in that area in Greece, because Muslims are going to come in and take it over in 1453, but through its missionary work and its spread, it's going to survive north into Russia, and you get the Russian Orthodox Church, which is basically an Eastern Orthodox Church and a descendant of this line right here. In the south, we had the church that is going to be another area, but we know the Vandals will come in, even in Augustine's day in the 400s. They will take over. They were Arian, and then the Muslims will finish them off in the 7th century as they take over North Africa. But that leaves us with the west, and we're going to see that it is the Germanic kingdoms that are going to come. We see the Arians and the Visigoths and I should say Arian Visigoths, who will come to power in Spain. We will see in England that we'll have the pagan Anglo-Saxons that will come to power. We'll deal with those later. But in the continent of Europe, what is today France particularly, we're going to see the pagan Franks come to power. And we'll look at a man by the name of Clovis, and then we'll go to Charlemagne. And then we'll see that even up into the 1800s, the Holy Roman Empire is going to come to the fore. Now, what's important to understand here as we start to look at what's going to go on, the popes were very threatened. They were in a very precarious position, those popes that we were just talking about. And the reason being is they were always facing extinction, barbarian invasion after another, the Muslim invasion coming in. And they were literally frequently about to be wiped out and off the face of the earth. And so they're forced into a position, where are we going to turn to support us in what we're trying to do in the Catholic Church? Well, they had a problem. They would have turned to Constantinople, but they couldn't. And why couldn't they turn there? Because in Constantinople, the Eastern emperors would always hold to the position that the emperor was the head of the church, was over the church, and that the church was subservient to that. And the Roman Catholic Pope was not going to want to turn and submit to that, so he couldn't go that way. So where was he going to turn? Well, where he was going to turn to was the Franks, Arian Christians who are going to come in. You remember Julius Caesar is going to go in the first century before Christ, go up into Gaul, which is present-day France, and establish the Roman Empire up there. And what we're going to see, that in 200s, these Franks are going to come from the east, and they're going to settle in Germany. And then by 300, they become a Roman ally, and they begin to, and remember, the Romans in 300s are well into decline now. They're going to spread into France, and eventually, in the 400s, they will embrace Arian Christianity, because the Eastern missionaries going north, hitting these Asians coming from China and coming from the east to the west, will Christianize them, Arian Christians, though they're not Orthodox Christians, they're Christians nevertheless. They will settle into France, they embrace Arian Christianity, and what's going to happen is that in 481, Clovis becomes the king, and he will unite the Frankish people. He will conquer Gaul, France, the Romans there, and the Germanic tribes in present-day France. Then something unusual happens. He's going to marry a Burgundian princess. This is just to the southeast of them, and what would today still be a part of France and part of Germany. Her name was Clotilda. I love that name. Isn't that just a neat name? You all mothers can use that one for your next daughter there, Clotilda. And he marries her, but she was a genuine Christian. It was obviously an arranged marriage for political purposes. He's trying to consolidate his kingdom. He marries a Burgundian princess to bring them under his control. And she has a great influence on Clovis to the point where he converts to Christianity and all of his kingdom follows his conversion. Because once the king becomes a Christian, you become a Christian. There's interesting stories that are told about this, that he insisted at a certain period of time that all Franks be baptized. And so they went and submitted them. But many of them, when they were baptized, left their right hand up when they went under. And now that was not a salute or a sign of allegiance, but what they were saying is that they were accepting Christianity, except for this part, so that they could still wield the sword. They were barbarian, and they wanted to be able to act like barbarians when they were conquering and doing what barbarians did. But they submitted, at least in name only, to becoming Christians. And what's important is that they are going to not become Arian Christians. They're going to become Orthodox Christians, at least in name. Now, let me just say, Lee had asked a good question last week. How do we deal with these conversions? I mean, after all, you're having masses of people being baptized, some of them holding their hands up so they can still partly be barbarian. I mean, it's hard to assimilate all of this, but let me just say, Dr. Calhoun gives at least some explanation as to how we deal with this. First of all, there were really four reasons for conversions, or four ways people were converted to Christianity. First of all, by force. For example, the Frankish king saying, "You're my people, you will be Christians, and you will be baptized." You have other kings like Orlof in Norway who is going to tell those in the islands there near Norway that, look, you are my servants. He tells the emperor of those islands that are allied to him, you will become Christian, or I will see to it that you will be destroyed by the fire and the steel. He will kill you. And they became Christians. So you have forced conversions. That's one way that Christianity is going to be established. Another way is by perceived advantages. Christianity becomes the established religion, and if you want to be promoted into that culture, you're going to take the advantage of what it has to offer. You become a Christian. We see this particularly in China that we talked about last week in the Tang Dynasty, that ruled the largest city in the world, that ruled the largest area and the largest amount of people. The Tang Dynasty was a Christian dynasty, and if you wanted to be in that society and have a position of authority and influence, you were a Christian. When that dynasty died, so did Christianity. But nevertheless, it was perceived advantage. And then there was something Dr. Calhoun calls the power encounter. And here this was just really whose God was stronger. And a good example was given of a missionary who would go into Germany, and there was a god who was worshipped among those barbarian peoples called Thor. We get Thursday from it, but Thor god. And the symbol of it was this large tree. Anyway, this Christian missionary said, well, you know, they're worshiping this tree, and it's a symbol of their authority. I'm just going to go and cut their tree down. And he did. And they all thought he would die instantly because he attacked the god Thor's representative tree, and he didn't. And they thought, well, his God is stronger, and therefore it leads those barbarian peoples to accept his missionary work. The power encounter. Dr. Calhoun talks a lot about this. If you go to Haiti, one of the questions those Haitians today will ask you is your God stronger than the God of voodoo? And give me an instance of it. So anyway, that's one example, the power encounter. Another way, obviously, was true conversions. People genuinely converted in their heart. Well, I don't know how to assimilate all of these different things or how to perceive it, but this much we know. Christianity was established one way or the other, and it is going to have a bearing here. And so the Franks are going to come to power. Clovis will establish the kingdom that will be used of God to preserve Western Christianity. Now, that's the important thing. It is the Franks who are going to align with the popes, and between the two of them, they will have a good union. The Franks will protect the Roman Catholic Church, and the Roman Catholic Church will bless the Franks. And so they will work together, and it is through this that we will see the church established. Now, this is the map that I want you to see, if I can, basically what you have right here, you can see this purple here, it says the Kingdom of the Franks. It starts out there. Here is the Kingdom of the Burgundians, where he's going to marry Clotilde and unite these two. And we'll see that it is going to start off very small, just so that you can get a picture. Here's the boot of Italy kicking the football of Sicily into Africa. This area down here is where the Vandals are. This is the the Eastern Roman Empire right here. You'll have the Visigoths over here. Up here, you'll have the Jutes, and you have the Saxons, names that you'll become familiar with as we go on into church history. And so that is the kingdom that he's going to work from and establish. Well, what happens is Clovis is going to make himself a king, and he is going to establish the first dynasty that we're going to find, called the Merovingian dynasty. And it is this dynasty that is going to really provide the line that will protect the church. Clovis dies, and as is often is going to be the case through the next 600 years, when the king dies, his kingdom is divided equally among his heirs, male heirs, which is different than usually what happens is it, in more recent times, when the king dies, it goes to who? The firstborn. Well, this one, divide it up equally, give it to the heirs, and then they're equal rulers, which was just a recipe for disaster, and it really was. And so what happens is his sons were weak rulers, and they're going to be supplanted by what are called mayors of the palace. Basically, this would be like prime ministers or governors, and they'll be over areas, and they really become the source of power. All that to say is that the kingdom that he establishes, the Merovingian kingdom, doesn't last in its strength and power, united under one, much after Clovis. But Pepin, who is a mayor of the palace, is going to come to the fore and begin to bring unity back. You can see it's 570 to 639. It's later on. He's particularly going to support missionary endeavors to the pagans, the Frisians, the Hessians, and the Saxons. And we go then to his son, Charles Martel, who is a mayor of the palace as well. And why these are really important is that it's during this time period that Islam is threatening Western existence. And in 732, in France, in Western France, the Muslims have invaded and are taking over Europe literally. And Charles Martel, also called the Hammer, goes and defeats them at the Battle of Tours. And this is the high water mark of Islam as far as it is concerned in Europe. And he is able to drive them back and preserve Western Christianity that we know. So that's why we put him there. But what happens is this dynasty is going to come to an end, the Merovingians, and we'll get what is called the Carolingian dynasty. And out of this, we'll come to Charlemagne the Great, which is our focus. But I want you to see Pepin the Short, unrelated to Pepin. Pepin the Short, who is a mayor of the palace in an area in 1714, is going to seek to come to power as a king over the whole empire. And he's going to dethrone the Merovingians, who are weak kings. He actually overthrows them. There is a coup, and he claims the power to himself. Why this is important is that Pope Zacharias is going to consecrate what Pepin did. Now think about that. What does he do? There is an existing Merovingian king. He is going to come and overthrow it. And what does the Pope say? He says, that's okay. I approve of it. And now you're starting to see again the development of the popes and their ability to say who can rule and who can't rule. And it's going to bring the popes into this nation-state business. Pope Zacharias is again pressed by the Lombards, and so Pepin is going to send his army from France down into Italy to free the city of Rome from the attack of the Lombards. And what does he do? He defeats them. He takes the land that the Lombards have, and he's going to give the donation of Pepin, that is, the Papal States, to the Pope. And now, for the first time in history, the Pope is going to become both a temporal ruler over lands, the Papal States, as well as the spiritual leader of the Church. And so now, again, you start to see the mixing of the Roman papacy with temporal and spiritual power, and this is really another huge change in the papacy. They're beginning to rule states and have temporal power as well as the concern of the spiritual. He'll die in 768, and the next ruler that comes is Charlemagne. But let's draw some consequences to what has come out of this. For the first time, a pope, as we said, is claiming apostolic authority involving the right to dethrone a king and to put a king on the power. And now this is going to play out and play out over and over again, even up into the Reformation and Henry VIII and his struggle with the Roman Catholic Church over can I divorce my wife or not divorce my wife, and the church excommunicating. This is going to be a common theme coming out of this time period. This is also going to sever the link between the Roman papacy and the Byzantine Empire. Why? Because the Pope does not turn to the Byzantine Empire for help. He turns to the Frankish kingdom for help. And so now the East and the West are permanently split, never to be joined again. It's going to seal the military, political, and religious bond between the Franks and the papacy. And so we're going to see now, not only is the East broken off, but we're going to see this clear line between the Franks and the papacy. And then finally, as we said, Pepin gave the papacy a huge independent state in Italy in transferring these popes from religious leaders to secular government rulers, as well as spiritual leaders, changing the nature of the papacy. And these are important consequences and themes that will play out through the Middle Ages, as we will see. Even to this day, we still struggle with the relationship of the church to the state. And we as Christians better be very careful about how much we want our political leaders to be aligned with and attuned to the church and what they do. And I only say that because, remember, it goes both ways. Do we want a Roman Catholic? Do we want a Muslim leading us? Do we want a Christian leading us? And so we really need to think through what the consequences are. And we've got a lot of church history to go back and look at. Do we really want a spiritual leader as the head of the nation? We want a spiritual person there. But the question is, what's the tie in the relationship? We better be careful. We may get what we ask for.
Was he referred to as Pope as civil leader as well as spiritual, or did he have a dual title? Is he called a king and an emperor and pope, or that's just a...
That's a good question. And I actually believe later on they will actually have a title. Let me look and see if I can get an answer. But I'm trying to think what the title is, but I think it's going to be later that it's going to be evolved. But you have the Papal State still to this day, not in the same form that you have, but you have the Vatican, which is an independent country that, as you remember, Ronald Reagan was the first president to send an ambassador from the United States to the papacy. And so you actually have a country that is a sovereign country that the Pope rules over. But I don't know if there's a specific title that he holds in that. Does anybody else know?
I think he does. I don't know what it is. But they also have an army, right?
Yes. During this time he did, but the army today is the Swiss Guards who provide his protection, per se. But it is a neutral state. I've never known them to enter, in modern history, any foreign conflict. And even during World War II, the papacy was neutral. In other words, even Hitler did not invade or take it over. Even Hitler. So that tells you something. All right, Charles the Great then. We come to Charles the Great. He will reign over the Frankish kingdom in 771 to 814, and he is going to create the first great empire since Rome. And this is significant because, think about what I'm saying, he's going to unite a large area under his control. He will be the emperor. And one of the things that you always remember is it is very hard for there to be the establishment and prosperity of a culture, spiritually, intellectually, as long as it's lacking peace. But when you're able to bring peace to an area, it generally is going to prosper, spiritually as well as physically. And so that'll be one of the blessings that he will do. He's called the Moses of the Middle Ages. He's going to lead the Germanic people out of barbarism, and he'll give them a new code of civil and ecclesiastical laws. Now, it's interesting. He was a 7-foot-tall man. Even by today's standards, that's large. In those days, he was gigantic. He had long, flowing white hair. He was a huge man. They said he could never write, even if he had learned. His fingers were so big, he couldn't grab the small end. He was a huge man. And he was a powerful man. He was a perfect barbarian king and ruler. He was able to wield the sword. He was an outdoorsman. He loved to hunt and to fish. But God put in him a great desire for interest in culture, in music, in literature, and education. And this will have a great effect upon the church and the prosperity of the church. It's amazing how God fits people for what they're doing. Like we saw with Augustine, he made him just perfect for what he needed to do. And God does that here again. What are the major contributions of Charlemagne? Well, first of all, he was a great military leader. He will have over 50 campaigns. Sustained battles where he will conquer the Lombards in Italy, the Muslims in Spain, not all of it, but a good bit of it. He will expand the German frontier east in Bavaria. He'll defeat pagan Avars in Hungary. 18 campaigns over one of the most fierce people on the earth, Saxons. Brutal, terrible people. 30 years he'll fight them and finally conquer them. He'll expand his kingdom, and again he forces conversions of the enemy as he does it. And he establishes order out of this barbarian chaos. He was an able administrator. We've seen this before. To have an empire like he is going to have, he had a unique gift of organization and administration, and it helped him sustain that empire. Now, this is his empire. You can see here is Italy. You can't see it all. Here is Spain. Here is present-day England. This is where, later into his kingdom, and then finally these green sections he will add as he expands what we really have quite a bit of Europe as we know it today under his rule. This will give you a better picture of it right here. The yellow that you see down here is the Eastern Empire under Constantinople, and it really bumps up to Charlemagne's empire. The Carolingian Renaissance that Charles the Great, in the French it would be Charlemagne, was what that means, is going to bring. And this is probably what is most significant for church history. He is going to bring about a great intellectual renaissance, and the monasteries are become the focal point of this knowledge of culture in the West. He will insist upon the monasteries doing this. He will recruit Alcuin from England to come and establish a palace school where he was. He was interested in learning. He wanted to learn. He was going to promote this. He will, in this palace school, in his palace, he will have the Roman culture, basically classical education, recovered and instituted among the Germanic people. And there will be great learning, Christian learning, that will flow from this. It's also interesting to note that out of this, language will be developed. The letters that you write today are going to be developed by Charlemagne in this time period. The literature, he's going to direct monk scholars to preserve ancient works and establish libraries to contain them. We'll see this, Lord willing, we'll see this as the time goes on today with Gottschalk, who was a monk in the monastery reading Augustinian theology that was preserved during this time period. He's going to revise the text of the Latin Bible to make sure that it was conforming to the manuscripts that they knew, going back to the Jerome Bible. Education. He is going to establish a school. Wherever there is a church, that church was charged with establishing a school for people to learn to read and write. And he was going to insist that both the poor and the rich get educated. And in these educations, you're going to see the study of logic and philosophy and literature, that classical education that came out of the ancient Roman Empire, reestablished among his people. And again, this is critical to the preservation of so much of the work that you and I benefit from today, from these barbarian people. Well, the emperor of the Romans. Pope Leo III now is on the throne, and he's forced to flee Rome because of political factions, fightings going on in Rome, and he flees to Charlemagne. And Charlemagne is going to return with Pope to Rome with his army to support Leo. And as a result of this, on Christmas Day in 800, Leo III is going to crown the emperor, Charlemagne, while he's receiving communion. Charlemagne doesn't know what the Pope is about to do. He goes up to the Pope. We have a picture of it here. Let me see if I can get to it. This is a Roman Catholic rendition of it. The Pope is sitting on the seat up here. You can see the seat here, and if you can, there's the Pope right there. He's as white as the background is. Here is King Charlemagne. He is about to receive communion, what he thinks is going to be communion from the Pope, and then the Pope plops a crown on his head, not telling Charlemagne what he was going to do. But what was he doing? He says to Charles Augustus, and there's different renditions of this, to Charles Augustus, crowned by God, great and peacemaking emperor of the Romans, long life and victory. Here we have a pope making a king. Charlemagne's not pleased by this at all, by the way, because he wasn't about to be subservient to a Roman pope. But nevertheless, this is the way the pope was trying to get his authority. Charlemagne was going to be made the supreme ruler of the Western world, and this will be much to the dismay of the Byzantine Empire. They are still hoping to regain the world and its throne. But what we see here is the king, according to what the Pope had done, is subservient to the Pope, though Charlemagne would seek to fight and maintain control of spiritual matters in the church. Well, what was his religious influence? Charlemagne saw himself as the spiritual and political leader of the empire, and he would appoint, not the Pope, all the bishops in his kingdom. He would refuse to allow the Pope to do that. He reformed the monasteries. There obviously was moral decay, and he established a moral code of conduct. He forbid the work on Sundays. He made tithes of everybody's income compulsory in his land, and so you had to tithe by law during this time period. You can see the great wealth that would have brought into the church during that time period. He would enter into doctrinal debate. When he conquered Spain, or portions of Spain from the Muslims, there was false teaching about the person of Christ, the fact that he was really adopted by the Father. He didn't have a divine nature. He was really a human, adopted by the Father, and he will reject that and stand strong for the Nicene orthodoxy of the person of Christ, fully God and fully man. And so we're going to see his influence upon the doctrines that you and I hold dear during this time period. He's going to support the insertion of the Filioque clause in the Nicene Creed. And he will help the Pope stand against the Eastern Church in these things. When he dies, you can see the full extent of his kingdom here, going all the way over into, you know, here's Greece, and Turkey's going to be down here. This would be like Hungary and I want to say Czechoslovakia. It is no more. The Slavic countries down in this area here. But what happens is, as you can see, there's a dotted line that goes through here and another dotted line that goes through here. Again, his three sons are going to divide up the kingdom when he dies, and we'll see the diminution of his empire. Let me just say this. What is important about this is that the popes and the Roman Catholic Church and Orthodox Christianity is going to survive this tumultuous time period. Perfectly? No. Nevertheless, the Orthodox Christian teachings that you and I hold to today are going to survive because of this relationship of the Roman Catholic Church to the Frankish Kingdom, whether it was the Merovingian dynasty or the Carolingian dynasty. You'll see that come. Well, in the time that we have left here, let's talk about Augustinianism. What happened to it after Augustine died? Well, we remember in 529 there was a council, the Synod of Orange, that basically is going to endorse Augustinianism, a weakened form of it. And it basically is going to stay in the vernacular of the church as an accepted doctrine in the church. But it's going to not be fully accepted, and they'll have highs and low periods. But what happens is a man by the name of Gottschalk in 808, think about the time period, it's 400 years after Augustine lived. This is just, he's born just at the time of the Charlemagne's empire. Remember what we said was going on here, this Carolingian Renaissance in the monasteries, where there's this great emphasis of collecting the classical historical books and works and literature and putting them into libraries and cataloging them, and there's the rereading of all of this educational material that came out of the ancient church. Well, Gottschalk is one of those monks that is going to be the benefit of the Carolingian Renaissance. He is born, and his parents give him to the monastery, basically vowing him. He becomes a monk, not by his own free choosing. It's interesting to note, he seeks to undo that vow of his parents and get out of the monastery, and he will burn a lot of bridges with the people at this time. He's able to get out of his monastery, but he's transferred to another. He never gets out of being a monk, though he wanted to badly. But he's going to establish relationships with the head of those monasteries that will come back to haunt him. Gottschalk was not necessarily known for his tact and his political savvy. He was a very frank and bold and in-your-face kind of guy. So we'll see that come to bear a little bit here. But as some have, and as he, I think, would try and understand of his study of Augustinianism, he would define it this way. God, according to an unconditional decree, out of his own free grace, chooses some to whom he imparts the grace necessary for their conversion, and he leaves the rest to suffer the penalty of the law according to merit. Right, so this is his teachings that he is going to bring to the fore out of his study in the monastery of Augustine. But what does he do? He begins then to start charging church leaders with Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism. He's not making friends. And his dealings with his relationship to the monastery, he's already burned some bridges. So these guys have got his number. They're not pleased with him at all. And so he's going to be brought before the Synod of Mayence in 848, and they're basically going to condemn his views and call him a heretic. He goes to another synod, and they again repeat that he is a heretic, and they reject his teachings. He will be imprisoned, he will be beaten, and he'll be left in the monastery the rest of his life. But here's what I think is important. By the way, they're going to misrepresent his view by saying that he was teaching that the elect assure of salvation, whatever their conduct, and that the non-elect could have no opportunity to salvation. Now, is that not a pejorative view of the doctrines of Augustine? And we hear this frequently, people responding that way even to what we believe. And that was it's a common theme that is going to go through church history. He was scourged and imprisoned. But what are the lessons we take from Gottschalk? First of all, yes.
It does seem that their understanding of it would derive from his statement that they couldn't understand what he was saying.
Well, I think we're trying to summarize what his views would have gone. He would have been able to have gone through. I've not been able to develop it. But he would spend much time and portray accurately Augustinianism and going through and dealing with that, and they would reject it and respond negatively to it. The doctrine of God's absolute sovereignty is one thing that we see, is over all things, and has never been a very popular doctrine. And it constantly is going to be battled against. But what is key here is that out of the Carolingian Renaissance, Augustinianism is not dead. It is still known among the people. It is still being talked about. It is still being debated. And it is still within the Catholic Church. It'll be times not as prevalent and, shall we say, prevailing in the doctrine of the Church. But when it comes back to the Reformation, it's not like it's been gone for 1,000 years and all of a sudden they rediscover it. It has been in the doctrines and the discussion of the Church. We should be aware of an imbalance and a tactlessness and a lack of moderation and charity in our zeal to promote the biblical truth of the doctrines of grace. He was not that way. He was more in your face and charging Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism of his rulers. It's one thing to hold the doctrines. It's another thing to try and persuade people winsomely of these things. It's also another thing to be balanced, to see that it is not the most critical thing in your dealing with others, how you come across. And so we must be careful that we're winsome, that we hold to the doctrines in a way that are true, but that we don't beat people to death with them, and it's not the only thing we can talk about. We must be moderate in how we deal with that, and Gottschalk is going to learn the hard way. Although the truth may appear to be compromised and counseled away by professing Christians, it cannot ultimately be destroyed. And I think this is what I'm trying to say here as I summarize really what David Scott in the past has put together. Truth will continue to triumph. And as long as there's people under God's direction seeking the truth, we're going to see these truths again bubbling up and coming to the fore and in the discussion of the church. Well, we've seen the rise of the papacy. We've seen how the church is going to be preserved with the Frankish Empire. And we've talked about Gottschalk just to see what was going on in the church as far as Augustinianism and trace it through. Lord willing, next week David will be back and he's going to begin to show the missionary endeavors. And he's going to talk then particularly about what happened in Britain and the missionary work coming out of that. Any thoughts or questions before we end? Very good. We'll look forward to seeing you guys next week.